grew up in a house of journalists. Both my parents worked on the local newspaper. My dad had obviously, before he started having kids and mortgages and so on, had spent quite a lot of money on hardbacks. Once I started to get into books myself, one of the great pleasures was just wandering into the living room and having this sort of floor-to-ceiling selection of books to pick from. Having said that, my father was not a literary reader, and he had obviously grown up in the days of Pulp Fiction, and his tastes tended to run to things like Horatio Hornblower and sort of respectable, lightweight fiction. He was not a great reader of the classics, which is how I happened on Lost Horizon, which is the wonderful book by James Hilton, a British author about Shangri-La. And it was one of the first adult books I read. I mean, I was just ready to move into this new phase of my reading life. And I was just captivated. I mean, the very start of it, I think the first words are cigars had burned low. You felt as if you were in the hands of a master storyteller. And it's a great story. I mean, you know, yarns don't get any better than that one. And it's just completely gripping. It was to me then. And when I was going through the house making these selections, I found that I sat down and read Lost Horizon for about an hour when I should have been doing other things. In this extract I've chosen, it's about the hero of the book, Glory Conway, who was in the manner of this sort of fiction in the 1930s. He was one of these incredibly good-looking, intelligent Oxbridge types who could do almost everything, spoke a number of languages, played the piano flawlessly, was a real hero. And, of course, I mean, it probably seems a little ridiculous now, but I actually bought into every bit of it. I thought such people actually existed. I was from Des Moines, Iowa. I didn't know any better then. This is read by Bill Wallace.
He was just brilliant. There's no other word. After the war, people said he was different. I myself think he was. But I can't help feeling that with all his gifts, he ought to have been doing bigger work. All that Britannic majesty stuff isn't my idea of a great man's career. And Conway was, or should have been, great. You and I have both known him, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say it's an experience we shan't ever forget. And even when he and I met in the middle of China, with his mind a blank and his past a mystery, there was still that queer core of attractiveness in him. Rutherford paused reminiscently and then continued. As you can imagine, we renewed our old friendship on the ship. I told him as much as I knew about himself, and he listened with an attention that might almost have seemed a little absurd. He remembered everything quite clearly since his arrival at Chungkyang. And another point that may interest you is that he hadn't forgotten languages. He told me, for instance, that he knew he must have had something to do with India because he could speak Hindustani. At Yokohama, the ship filled up, and among the new passengers was Steve King, the pianist, en route for a concert tour in the States. He was at our dining table and sometimes talked with Conway in German. That will show you how outwardly normal Conway was. Apart from his loss of memory, which didn't show in ordinary intercourse, there couldn't have seemed much wrong with him. A few nights after leaving Japan, Steve King was prevailed upon to give a piano recital on board, and Conway and I went to hear him. He played well, of course. Some Brahms and Scarlatti and a lot of Chopin. At last he left the piano and moved towards the door, still followed by admirers, but evidently feeling that he had done enough for them. In the meantime, a rather odd thing was beginning to happen. Conway had sat down at the keyboard and was playing some rapid, lively piece that I didn't recognize, but which drew Steve King back in great excitement to ask what it was. Conway, after a long and rather strange silence, could only reply that he didn't know. Steve King exclaimed that that was incredible and grew more excited still. Conway then made what appeared to be a tremendous physical and mental effort to remember, and said at last that the thing was a Chopin study. It was never printed. I only know it myself from meeting a man who used to be one of Chopin's pupils. Rutherford steadied me with his eyes as he went on. I don't know if you're a musician, but even if you're not, I dare say you'll be able to imagine something of Steve King's excitement, and mine too, as Conway continued to play. Steve King was naturally engrossed in the musical problem, which was perplexing enough, as you'll realize when I remind you that Chopin died in 1849. The last episode was about making some phonograph records. Steve King said he would fix up all arrangements as soon as he reached America, and Conway gave his promise to play before the microphone. I often feel it was a great pity, from every point of view, that he wasn't able to keep his word. because that night, the night after the recital, he got back his memory.
I just love that book. I mean, I still do. And I think there's something wonderful about those kinds of books. They're so much a part of their time that it is a little bit like time travel to read them. For some reason, you know, when I start off writing a book, finding your voice is the hardest part. Because, I mean, it's just me, and it's just the same voice each time. But for the first few weeks, it just all seems very, very wooden. And it's sort of like getting into a pool of icy water or something. Eventually, you acclimatize to it. My big project at the moment is that I'm working on a book on Australia. I've just finished the weeping part. It actually started the real sitting down and writing part. I'm now not only enjoying it, but deliriously happy stage where I go to bed at night, can't wait to get up in the morning because I'm so into it. The Hardy Boys books, Hardy Boys are brothers in a fictional place called Bayport, and they're the son of a great detective. And this series of books was written by a man named Franklin W. Dixon. Only I discovered years later and was devastated to discover that he never actually existed. There was just a whole series of people that used the name Franklin W. Dixon. But I inherited, I had a brother who's 9 years older than me, and I inherited quite a large number of books, Hardy Boy books, from him. He was enough older than me that they seemed kind of venerable by the time they came to me. So they had these wonderful, evocative jackets that always showed some kind of danger. It usually showed the Hardy Boys in some position where they had just discovered something, a catch of gold or something, and just about to step out of the shadows as a bad guy. And I was completely captivated by the look of these jackets. And as soon as I got old enough to read, that's what I got into. And loved them. And I still got the Hardy Boy books at home and wouldn't part with them for anything. I mean, even now, you know, I can't possibly read them from cover to cover for pleasure. But there is a certain magic in just dipping into them and reading a page or two. When I was making my selection for this program, it was one of the most enjoyable parts. So this is an extract from the book The Disappearing Floor, read by Carrie Shale.
Frank suddenly awoke to the loud snapping of twigs. For an instant he lay motionless. With every muscle taut, he listened, trying to tell from what direction the sounds were coming. The noise ceased. Straining his eyes into the shadows beyond the dying campfire, the boy gave a start of surprise as he spied a crouching figure. For several seconds it remained still, then began to creep stealthily toward them.
"Joe! Chet! Wake up!"
With a cry of alarm, Frank leaped to his feet and flung himself toward the intruder. The shadowy form wheeled about and dived into the underbrush.
"There he goes!" the lad shouted,
pointing at the spot as his companions dashed up. The elder Hardy Boy, leading the way, suddenly felt the ground give way sickeningly beneath his feet. For a horrible split second, he plunged downward through the inky blackness, then felt a crushing blow on his back as he hit something solid. His head swam. There came a shout almost at his elbow, followed by a piercing scream.
"Joe! Chet! Is that you?"
Frank gasped. There was a long silence, followed by a weak response.
I think so, Frank. Golly, what happened to us?"
"I knew we should have stayed home," spluttered Chet's terror-stricken voice. "We're lost in a cave, sure as you're born."
"We're in a cave, all right, but we're not lost," Frank said grimly. "You can see the stars through the hole we fell into."
"Mighty far-off hole, if you ask me," Joe muttered disconsolately. "We must have fallen 20 feet.
"Look!" Frank clutched his brother's arm in the blackness. What Joe saw as he gazed upward made him gasp with horror.
"It's closing! The entrance is closing!"
And that makes me want to read it all over again. My father, whose name was also Bill Bryson, I spent most of my life as Bill Bryson Jr., was a sports writer for the Des Moines Register and Tribune, the morning and evening newspapers in Des Moines, Iowa, and a really, really gifted writer. He was recognized by his peers, I think, as one of the best baseball writers in the country. It was always a mystery to me why he stayed in a provincial newspaper when clearly his talents could have taken him much further. And he never really was able to explain it. I think he actually just liked Des Moines, Iowa. But he did get to go off into the wider world in pursuit of his work. And the selection I've chosen, which is from a book of his journalism that my brother put together for the Iowa State University Press after my father died, it's called The Babe Didn't Point. It's a reference to Babe Ruth. It's just some of my dad's best columns. And when this book came out a couple of years after my dad died in 1986, he died, I realized to my shame that I hadn't really read much of his stuff when he was living. You know, I was growing up with him and I didn't really pay much attention to him as a writer. And then to see it all suddenly bound, gathered together in one volume, I remember reading it and thinking, hey, this guy could write. He's very good. And the selection I've chosen, a really quite typical example of his writing, it's from one of the most exciting World Series games, baseball World Series games in modern history. And it's about a guy named Bill Mazeroski who hit a home run that won the World Series for the Pittsburgh Pirates and thereby beat the previously indomitable New York Yankees, and much hated New York Yankees too in our household. And I just ask you to bear in mind as you listen to this that this was written by my dad within moments of the game finishing. This was straight off the top of his head.
Pittsburgh, PA. The most hallowed piece of property in Pittsburgh baseball history left Forbes Field late Thursday afternoon under a dirty gray sports jacket and with police escort. That, of course, was home plate, the Pentagon of rubber where Bill Mazeroski completed his electrifying home run while umpire Bill Jakowski, broad back braced and arms spread, held off the mob long enough for Mazeroski to make it legal. One of the 36,683 jubilant maniacs stole the plate, and a cop hauled him off. Pittsburgh's steel mills couldn't have made more noise than the crowd in this ancient park did when Mazeroski smashed Yankee Ralph Terry's second pitch of the ninth inning. Hysterical Patriots were leaping out of box seats and onto the field even before Bill's drive rocketed over the head of left fielder Yogi Berra. By the time the ball sailed over the ivy-covered brick wall, the rush from the stands had begun, and these sudden madmen threatened to keep Maz from touching the plate with the run that beat the lordly Yankees 10-9 for the title. 2 hours after this seventh World Series game, dozens of fans were walking in a happy daze around the scene of Pittsburgh's first world title victory since 1925.
And the thing that I think I most admire about my father was probably his sense of humor. Iowans have a great sense of humor anyway. I remember when I wrote The Lost Continent, which is a book that makes quite a lot of fun of Midwesterners. There was this strange experience I had when it was published in the States that it was really, really slammed by critics outside the Midwest and got really quite glowing reviews by people in the Midwest. And these were, you know, the people that I had been most merciless about in the book were the people that were responding to it most warmly. Journalism was a big part of my life. It was the family business. So that was what was talked about at dinner. That's what you did. And in any case, the only thing I was ever any good at in school was English and composition, that sort of thing. So there was no question. It just never occurred to me to do anything else. When I first read Scoop by Evelyn Waugh, I thought it was ridiculous. It seemed so exaggerated. And then I went to Fleet Street and I discovered that, in fact, it was totally plausible. Very, very like the sort of things that go on, the zaniness and the mistakes and what happens among people to put out a daily newspaper. And I just loved that book. I mean, I love Evelyn Waugh, anything he ever wrote, but I think this is my favorite of all his books, and partly because I know what he was talking about here.
He had never been to the Megalopolitan offices or met anyone connected with the Beast. His job as author of Lush Places had been passed on to him by the widow on the death of its previous holder, the rector of Boot Magna. He had carefully modelled his style on the late rector's, at first painfully, now almost without effort. The work was of the utmost importance to him. He was paid a guinea a time, and it gave him the best possible excuse for remaining uninterruptedly in the country. And now it was in danger. On the previous Thursday, a very dreadful thing had happened. Drawing on the observations of a lifetime, and after due cross-examination of the head keeper, and half an hour with the encyclopedia, William had composed a lyrical but wholly accurate account of the habits of the badger, one of his more finished essays. Priscilla, in a playful mood, had found the manuscript and altered it, substituting for badger throughout the crested grebe. It was not until Saturday morning, when in this form it appeared in The Beast, that William was aware of the outrage. His mail had been prodigious. Some correspondents were sceptical, others derisive. One lady wrote to ask whether she read him aright in thinking he condoned the practice of baiting these rare and beautiful birds with terriers and deliberately destroying their earthy homes. How could this be tolerated in the so-called 20th century? A major in Wales challenged him categorically to produce a single authenticated case of a great crested grebe attacking young rabbits. It had been exceedingly painful. All through the weekend, William had awaited his dismissal. But Monday and Tuesday passed without a word from the Beast. He composed and dispatched a light dissertation on water voles, and expected the worst. Perhaps the powers at the Beast were too much enraged even to send back his manuscript. When Wednesday's paper came, he would find another tenant of lush places. It came. He hunted frantically for his half-column. It was there, a green oasis between Waffle Scramble and the Bedtime Pets. Feather-footed through the plashy fens passes the questing vole. It was all right. By some miracle, Saturday's shame had been covered.
I remember when I worked on the Times, I was quite new on the Times working on the business desk, that I wrote in the main headline, in whatever size type we use, 68 point or something, but I mean, they're just sort of banner headline type size. I put, it was some sort of currency crisis, and I put pound falls to, it was supposed to say to $1.42 or whatever it was, and I put pound falls to pound sign 142. And it went through every edition of the paper, and nobody on the desk noticed it. And I went home, woke up the next morning, and I opened the paper, and there was this pound sign where there should have been a dollar sign. And this was one of my first big stories, you know, and I thought, oh, I've really, really done it, you know. I'll be sacked. This is it. I'm certainly going to be, you know, hauled all over the carpet when I get into work today. And do you know that not one person in the whole nation ever noticed that? I got to work, nobody noticed it, nobody called in, nobody sent a postcard. It was just quietly overlooked by everyone. And I've never been so grateful for anything like that in my life. S.J. Perlman was another incredibly funny writer. There was an elegance about his humor that no one else has ever come near to approaching. In this book, Swiss Family Perlman, I'm not sure when it was written, but I believe it was the late 50s, possibly even the early 60s. And yet the whole tone of it harkens back to a much earlier age, and indeed an entirely different kind of travel from that we would recognize now.
700 tons of icy green water curled off the crest of the California groundswell and struck with malignant fury at the starboard plates of the SS President Cleveland, westbound out of San Francisco for Honolulu, Manila, and Hong Kong. Midway along its deserted promenade, huddled in a blanket, a solitary passenger sprawled in his deck chair, pondering, between spasmodic intakes of breath, the tangled web of circumstance that had enmeshed him. To even the most cursory eye, and there was no shortage of cursory eyes among the stewards hurrying past, it was instantly apparent that the man was exceptional, a rara avis. Under a brow purer than that of Michelangelo's David, capped by a handful of sparse and greasy hairs, brooded a pair of fiery orbs, glittering like zircons behind 10-cent store spectacles. His superbly chiseled lips, ordinarily compressed in a grim line that bespoke indomitable will, at the moment hung open flaccidly, revealing row on row of pearly white teeth and a slim patrician tongue. In the angle of the obdurate outthrust jaw, buckwheat-flecked from the morning meal, one read quenchless resolve, a nature scornful of compromise and dedicated to squeezing the last nickel out of any enterprise. The body of a Greek god, each powerful muscle the servant of his veriest whim, rippled beneath the blanket, stubbornly disputing every roll of the ship. And yet this man, who by sheer poise and magnetism had surmounted the handicap of almost ethereal beauty, and whose name, whispered in any chancellery in Europe, was a talisman from Threadneedle Street to the Shanghai Bund, was prey to acute misery.
when you're working on a book, you have to read a lot of stuff that you probably wouldn't, in the normal course of things, choose to read. But very occasionally, you come across something that you have to read, but you're also delighted to read. And with Australia, the thing that stuck out with me was a biography of the great aviator, Charles Kingsford Smith. It wasn't quite as famous as Lindbergh, but his achievements were actually even greater. Whereas Lindbergh flew the Atlantic Ocean and then did very little else, Kingsford Smith was the first person to fly the Pacific, which is obviously a much bigger and harder, more arduous undertaking. So he has a great story, but it's also told extremely well by a man named Ian Mackersey, who has written his biography. And I just love this book.
Arriving over Suva early that afternoon, Tuesday the 5th of June, 1928, Smithy was horrified by the diminutive reality of the town's only landing area, a small sports ground, Albert Park. Not only was it too small, but it was surrounded on at least three sides by higher ground. The landing he eventually made was to become one of the most applauded feats of his legend. Much less known were the steps he took to try to find somewhere else to come down. Smithy was so aghast at the sight of that pocket handkerchief that he decided to fly off and look at some of the nearby beaches. They flew over several that looked okay, but he was worried the sand might be too soft. As his fuel was almost finished, he had to make a swift decision. He decided to have a shot at the park, knowing that he might well be forced to abort, in which event he'd decided to put down in the sea. To deal with this contingency, the government ship Pioneer was standing by. Two things worried him. He wanted to be sure that Harry and Jim could swim, and he wanted, for the park or the sea, to approach by dragging her in the slowest possible tail-down attitude. So he sent a note through, telling them to undress and climb back as far along the inside of the fuselage as they could get. Harry stripped down to his one-piece underclothes. Jim, of course, because of the heat, was already naked. Getting back to the rear of the fuselage wasn't as easy as it might sound. There was only a few feet of solid wooden floor around the radio navigation area. After that, the fuselage was just a skeleton of thin steel tubes and diagonal bracing wires encased in fabric. Scrambling through these obstacles, they could easily slip and fall, bursting right out into space through the bottom fabric. Well, they eventually squeezed their way back, both stone deaf, exhausted out of their minds, unable to see anything outside, and frightened as hell. It must have seemed like a bad dream, not knowing whether they were going to finish up in a pile of wreckage on land or underneath the sea. To mark the historic event, the British colonial governor, Sir Eyre Hudson, had declared a public holiday. A large crowd of whites, Fijians and Indians who had poured into Suva from the villages and plantations were held back by soldiers in khaki shorts and pith helmets as the plane touched down and careered towards a jungle-covered bank less than 200 yards away. But as people gasped and shouted, the plane suddenly performed a spectacular manoeuvre. Smithy swung hard left in a dramatic ground loop that miraculously spun round a tree, passing narrowly between this and another tree. The starboard wing barely missed the palms on the edge of the field. The wheels hit some soft ground and she began to tilt on her nose. Harry and Jim, huddled in the back, hanging on to bracing wires and trying to keep their weight off the fabric, felt the tail rise. It teetered for a moment, then fell back hard. As it dropped, poor Jim was knocked off his perch and crashed right through the fabric onto the ground. He hit his head and was knocked out cold. I suppose he was lucky the tail skid didn't run over him, because Smithy couldn't see what had happened and taxied away, leaving him there unconscious without a stitch on. According to Harry, as he began to come to, he was rescued from his embarrassment by a uniformed British nurse. She ran out from the crowd, took off her cape and wrapped it round his nakedness while she rendered first aid.
One of my favorite books of recent years, largely because it was just so unexpected, I knew nothing about it, never heard of it until I stumbled on it, was a book called The Ascent of Rum Doodle by W.E. Bowman, an Englishman. It was written in the 1950s. It's a very, very funny book. It's a parody of a mountain climbing adventure story. And it's just full of that type of humor that the British do so incredibly well. There's this constant element of zaniness about it. It's totally ridiculous, but also almost probable. I think you can see what I mean in this last passage we're going to hear.
After 3 hectic months of preparation, we met in London on the eve of our departure for a final review of our plans. Only Jungle, who was to have spoken on the use of the radio gear and his own methods of route finding, was absent. He rang up to say that he'd taken the wrong bus and was not quite certain of his whereabouts, but he had just caught sight of the North Star and expected to join us shortly. Burley, although not at his best, he told me he was suffering from London lassitude, gave us a detailed picture of the transportation arrangements. The object of the expedition was to place 2 men on the summit of Rumdoodle. This necessitated the establishment of a camp at 39,000 feet, stocked with a fortnight's supplies for 2, so that in the event of adverse weather conditions the party could wait in comfort for an improvement. The equipment for this camp had to be carried from the railhead at Chikosi, a distance of 500 miles. 5 porters would be needed for this. 2 porters would be needed to carry the food for these 5, and another would carry the food for these 2. His food would be carried by a boy. The boy would carry his own food. The first supporting party would be established at 38,000 feet, also with a fortnight's supplies, which necessitated another 8 porters and a boy. In all, to transport tents and equipment, food, radio, scientific and photographic gear, personal effects and so on, 3,000 porters and 375 boys would be required.
With Great Pleasure, Bill Bryson, was produced by Mary Ward Lowry with readings from Kerry Shale and Bill Wallace. It was originally broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on the 30th of September 1999.